Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about Maria of Ágreda, who is a mystical Spanish nun of the 17th century. Right now, I would like to welcome Jessica Helfand. She is a graphic designer. She teaches design at Yale University, and she's author of the book Scrapbooks, An American History, published by Yale University Press. Welcome, Jessica, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
And so we are talking in advance of National Scrapbooking Day, which I didn't even know existed. It's this coming Sunday. And you've done this history of scrapbooks. It's so fascinating. When did people start keeping scrapbooks and why?
Well, I think they've kept them for a very, very long time. Certainly people kept diaries forever. And I became interested in them probably 20 years ago when I was a graduate student, and I discovered among the treasures in the Beinecke-Rare Book Library at Yale that in with Ezra Pound's papers and other people's papers, they kept these things that were part visual, part verbal, kind of these compilations of random jottings. And over time, I came to see that they were, in fact, scrapbooks. And with the rise in popularity of scrapbooking as a hobby, it occurred to me that there was this rich arsenal of American history whose story had really not been told. And that's really what I set out to do with this book.
Is scrapbooking a particularly American phenomenon?
I don't know if it's particularly American, but I think in the period I covered in my book, which is about 1870 to about 1945, you know, we had two world wars, all sorts of changes in the art world and music. Women acquired the right to vote in 1920. So there were so many changes happening in a fairly short, less than a century's worth of time, that I realized by looking at many, many scrapbooks, you could almost chart this kind of idiosyncratic but very kind of deeply emotionally resonant course of people's lives, and then it would be an interesting way to tell the story of, say, the beginning of modernism in America, the beginning of industry in America, all sorts of things that we tend to think about being told by these very vetted sort of historical records that are more serious than first-person testimonies. But once you string a bunch of first-person testimonies together, and there were many, many scrapbooks kept during this period, you had a fairly accurate, not necessarily linear, but I think fairly faithful record of what went on in people's lives and in this country at that time.
As you point out in the book, the rise of modernism goes hand in hand with a kind of alienation that people feel, and scrapbooks are a way of trying to stay non-alienated in some way.
I think, too, people have asked me, it's an excellent question that you ask, and similarly, why didn't people just write down what was happening to them? And I think many of us don't trust our ability to verbalize the depths of emotion and the complexity. Certainly, while something's happening to you, you often can't figure it out, and many people use their diaries to figure things out. And what I found in my research was that people use scrapbooks very much for that same purpose, and that while they were figuring out the changes going on around them and becoming bolder, in a sense, to your point, more willing to experiment with their own perceptions, which might not be the status quo perceptions, that they could rip out a picture and put in a caption and change it later, that there's no sort of recipe for what a scrapbook needed to look like back then. And so some of them are very very sort of structured and rigorous, and others are really chaotic, and people went backwards and forwards and annotated and excavated, and there's all sorts of changes that are being reflected in the very medium and the way with which the ways people actually express the medium in their scrapbooks. And that's, as a visual person, which was my primary point of entry, what was the most exciting to me was that these people who were not visual like I am felt compelled for whatever reason to keep these remarkably visual records of their lives.
They seem to be a less private form than diaries. Did they traditionally have an intended audience? I mean, if somebody opens your diary, you kick them out and never speak to them again. It's a violation. If somebody opens your scrapbook, it's not really like that. But could you tell if there was or who wasn't the intended audience?
You could sometimes tell who was the intended audience. It's an interesting thing. I mean, certainly there were some scrapbooks I saw that were more private. Occasionally I would find addressee envelopes pasted side down I have at least one example of what clearly was a scrapbook kept to document a tryst, and the people within the tryst are not really named. And so every once in a while you would see these kind of compilations, these visual kind of constructed collages of things that are a little bit cryptic in terms of deciphering what was going on. But at the same time, there was a whole trajectory through high school and college when young women and men kept scrapbooks and very clearly shared them with each other. And I even found a strain of what I remember from my childhood or middle-aged time of my childhood as being similar to what were slam books. The books you passed around class where you wrote, you know, favorite teacher, favorite boy's name, and all sorts of other things that were pointless, except that you took kind of informal census poll of your classmates to see how many people, you know, were listening to the Beatles that week. Well, the slam books really had an interesting origin in confession albums of the late 19th century, as I found. And, of course, the questions they asked in the 1890s were very different than what they were asking in the 1980s. But be that as it may, there were certain things that you could see people were taking polls. And this was became more and more popular after the war. In the 1940s, for example, I came upon several examples of something called the hymn book, as in H-I-M. And these were ways of just keeping, you know, records of all the boys that you liked. And so these were, you know, clearly to be meant to be shared among girls. But there were equal things happening in boys' scrapbooks where they were comparing sports statistics for favorite teams. So it really goes back and forth all over the place. But I have to say that the scrapbooks that were the most interesting were the ones that were probably where the line between privacy and public life blurs a little bit, where you really think that people kind of use these as a kind of itinerant canvas with which to record the various things going on in their life. So one minute it would be dance cards from a dance, and the next minute they're really sort of puzzling out how to make sense of the Lindbergh kidnapping or another tragedy that they're very interesting in young people, especially the first time you experience some major tragic event. And there certainly were many of them at the beginning of the 20th century. There's scrapbooks that kept during this, when the Hindenburg crashed and when the Titanic went down and when the Lindbergh kidnapping happened and the Kennedy assassination. People would use their scrapbooks not just to save things because they thought they would become valuable, but to save things to make sense of something of such epic proportion that they couldn't even talk about it. And that's what I found the most compelling and the most poignant. And that's where you say, well, they didn't have an iPhone, they didn't have cable, they didn't have what I have. But guess what? They were dealing with something really tragic. And right. And that, I think, is what's really humbling when you look at scrapbooks from such a long time ago, is you realize that, you know, we're all just people. We're all just people struggling to get by and make sense of our world.
I think one thing that's interesting about them, and one of the reasons that I've never kept something like that, is they're by necessity very much edited. You have to think about what you're going to put in and what you're going to leave out just as much. Did some of the books that you looked at leave you with kind of burning questions about the person who'd made them?
And they did. And I think probably some of my favorite scrapbooks were the ones where the mistakes were left in, where things are crossed out or mistakes are made, things are misspelled. Very often in the 40s and 50s when publishers jumped on the bandwagon and started to create, I write about this in my book, there's an entire chapter almost devoted to what were called memory books, these kind of books where you were told what to write down when your baby was born and what to save from a vacation. And they were kind of, you know, these enablers. And what I love is when people would save them and cross out what the publisher had written and put in their own thing. And this was particularly interesting for anybody studying the sort of the semantics and the patois of scrapbooks through the years. So, you know, for example, in the 1920s, a girl would go to a party, and a party was called a spread, and you would, like, write down what they served at the party. And at a certain point, people started crossing out spreads and writing in parties, and then the publishers realized they should call them parties, and they called them parties. So that's a kind of, on the very surface, a kind of an edited form where the editorial conceit is brought to bear by the person themselves. They bring their own inflections and their own nuances and their own priorities to the making of the scrapbook. But you're absolutely right that it does demand some editing, and every once in a while there were gaps between things or odd juxtapositions that didn't seem to make sense. Very often I saw photographs ripped out, and you break up with a boyfriend, you take a picture out of the book, or someone dies, or you know, someone leaves town and you know, you have a big fight. I mean, all sorts of ways people would use graphic representation to evoke a relationship that, again, they couldn't necessarily put into words. So I found over time that you would think that a person would get better at understanding scrapbook logistics, but it's not that clear because everybody's different and everybody sort of projects their sense of themselves in the world in a different way. And so you can think that you're reading the cues correctly, and then you turn the page and you've totally been getting it wrong. I have one example in the book that I have to share with you and your listeners, which is a book I was going through of a very wealthy man in New York who, during the Woodrow Wilson administration, was often invited to the White House, and he had one daughter who was not very pretty. The reason I know this is because she was in every debutante ball, and she'd coming out of the plaza, and she married a rich man. They sailed her off to England to be with him, and her photograph is never there. And there's all these other beautiful young girls who are there. I see little tiny pictures of her here and there, and I see that she's, you know, what I think we would call a handsome woman. She's not a great beauty. She's a handsome woman. Well, by the time I get three-quarters of the way through her father's scrapbook, I now know what the relationship he has is with his only daughter. She's now married and gone to live in England with her husband. And I now know his handwriting and her handwriting because I've read every page. And I get almost to the end of the scrapbook, and I see a letter he's saved from her, and on the back of it, I glimpse the sentence, he's just 4 months old now, and he's darling. And I assume, as any reader would, I think, in that circumstance, that she's gone the next logical step, and she's produced an heir. I read a few more pages, and I find that nothing could be further from the truth. She's divorced, she's back in New York, and she's talking about her puppy.
Right.
And I thought, you know, this is the joke's on me, and I must have looked at 1,000 scrapbooks at that point, and I realized, and I write this in the conclusion to the book, that you can't think you really know people. And one of the things that's so deeply humbling, I think, is that these scrapbooks really slow you down. They're so analog, but they're sort of beautifully analog. They're comically, clumsily analog, but that's what makes them so endearing.
We're talking to Jessica Helfand. She's author of the book Scrapbooks, An American History. What are the common items that people put in them, and what are the more unusual things that you've seen? Photographs and newspaper clippings and things like that are in most scrapbooks, but what are some of the stranger things?
Well, yes, and I have to say as a disclaimer that I was particularly interested in some of the weird things people say, because for every scrapbook I included, there's hundreds that are just photographs or just clippings, and I was more interested in the chaotic kind of eclecticism that I think is much closer to what life is. And so I found them more interesting to me, and also just visually, they're more interesting to me. But people saved firecrackers. They saved cigarette butts. They saved chewing gum. They saved lots of candy wrappers. And for a graphic designer like me, the typography and what things were called and there was a time when Hershey's, for example, had a slogan that was that chocolate was more sustaining than meat in the 1920s. I'd never seen this, and somebody saved this on a candy wrapper. I have one woman who saved a pocket watch. And throughout her scrapbook, she was notoriously late to everything. And you could see people would send her an invitation and say, Kitty, please be on time. You just got this impression this girl just never showed up on time. And the pocket watch has a little poem that someone had written to her that said, Kitty's always late. It seems to be her fate. So here's a little watch to help her keep her date. And this is like 1910 in Philadelphia. The scrapbooks I have are from all over the country, men as well as women, young, old, fat, thin, tall, short, rich, poor. Everybody kept them. It was not a gendered activity. There were certain things people kept more than other things. I mean, college girls kept party favors. And party favors during the 1920s involved stunts like flagpole sitting and silly stunts like, you know, do a somersault and whistle Dixie. And so they would save the little tricks that they did at parties. Lots of paper garters, lots of paper napkins. Occasionally things that are just goofy, twigs. Also, it's interesting and probably worth noting, just for the visual patina of these pages, that Scotch tape wasn't invented until the late 1920s. So people had to adhere these things in some way, and if they didn't have photo corners, which were the logical thing that came out of photo albums, they used chewing gum, they used bandages, they used all sorts of things at their disposal that were not the orthodox adhesives we would think of using today. Nor were they archival, I should say. And that's kind of what makes them beautiful. And you see things slipping and yellowing and tearing, and I think that's part of their beauty.
And I understand better now why they're called scrapbooks.
They are. And I think what's so interesting to me is that they were not two-dimensional books. And some of the books that I have, and it's a nightmare for archivists, a lot of the books that I have are really falling apart. And in libraries, they're falling apart. This is certainly true of anybody who's famous. And I don't have a lot of famous people's scrapbooks in my book, although I was interested in people's scrapbooks before they became famous. And that's really like looking for a needle in a haystack. Although I did find Lillian Hellman's scrapbook, and I found Anne Sexton, the poet's scrapbook. And hers is one of the most endearing because she was 19, she eloped, and she kept the scrapbook for the first year of her married life. And it's really goofy and really silly, and it's full of Campbell's soup recipes. And then, you know, her writing sort of the beginnings of these snippets of poems. And so it's very interesting on many levels.
Right.
But people didn't just save paper. And so these books are sort of overflowing and falling apart. And when you go to libraries, you often see them on microfiche or you see them behind plastic And it obliges the archivist or the librarian to, in fact, deconstruct the scrapbook. A good librarian will keep it in some kind of sequenced condition so that a scholar or a reader or just an interested scrapbooker can come and look and see the pages in which they were, what their intended order was, which I think is really important because you really need to try as best you can to understand whatever loopy chronology is being put forth in these pages.
So in the 19th century, you point out that people included colorful cards and things like that just simply because they weren't black and white. And it's such an interesting contrast when you think about it to our very colorful, image-saturated culture that we're living in right now.
It's true. And you know, I didn't want to organize the book chronologically because to me that would be the story of printing. I mean, I could tell that story. First there was black and white, and then there was color. That's the story of printing. That's not the story of people. And I wanted this to really be driven by the kind of emotional truths that I thought people were trying to reveal in these pages and reveal visually in these pages. But in fact, when chromolithography first came on the scene, you know, your Sunday paper had color in it, and it was just a big thrill to cut out a picture of a baby or a cherub or a bird and stick it in your scrapbook just because it was colorful. And there were some interesting sidelines to that that had to do with construction of narrative, which I get at briefly, which I think is kind of interesting. There were scrapbook houses where people would actually create books where they cut out from furniture catalogs, furniture, and they would practice sort of the domestic conceit of learning how to keep a home. And later on, they became kind of the precursor to almost a telenovela where girls would actually just cut out pictures of what was basically a boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl story. And they would pair it with snippets of poetry and so forth and create their own little kind of, you know, soap operas. And so slowly scraps became, I think, a more eclectic, malleable way of expressing either fact or fiction. But they were no longer restricted to the kind of black and white columns all lined up in a row world that they'd had throughout most of the 19th century. And that said, I don't mean to denigrate those scrapbooks, and I mentioned some of them and even include one or two of them in my book, particularly the one that's all obituaries. I thought that was just too good to leave out. But it is just clippings. And very often what makes them beautiful is that people pasted them onto the pages of an existing book. So if you went to school, say, and you were done with your geometry text, you might paste pictures on top of that, and then you didn't have to buy a new book. Well, right. So for the person looking at it 100 years later, you see kind of equations coming up through the pictures of, you know, a lady trying on pantyhose, you know. So there's these very funny juxtapositions where you see people trying to experiment with new forms through the very kind of residual forms that exist in their life, like textbooks and phone books and furniture catalogs. Sears Roebuck catalogs were a favorite because they had so many pages. And when they were out of date, you could use them for a scrapbook.
So, as you said, males and females, both boys and girls, men and women, all kept scrapbooks. If you looked at a scrapbook and you didn't know whether it was a man or woman who did it, could you tell right away by the choice of what they put in it?
You can't necessarily. You really can't. There was a wonderful story about a man who was a selectman here in Connecticut, where I live, who kept a scrapbook of poetry and lost it and was in such despair over the loss of his poetry scrapbook that the Hartford Courant reported on it on at least two separate occasions. Like, if anybody knows where this is, please give it back to, you know, Halsey Philbrick, the Connecticut senator from whatever. So you wouldn't think that some guy in the public eye who was being a public servant would be so attached to his poetry scrapbook, but he was. And similarly, you know, there were many scrapbooks kept by physicians. There was a wonderful scrapbook kept by a man who lived in Seattle, who was an immigrant from the Philippines, who put himself through medical school, was very religious. Somewhere in him was a struggling graphic designer wanting to get out. He would just draw these incredibly elaborate borders around things. There was this wonderful kind of tension between his very logical, medical, church-going, very right-wing side and the fact that he loved art and loved form and loved women and loved sort of beautiful pictures of flowers. And so the scrapbook weighs 22 pounds. It's like this amazing repository of some man's other life as evidenced through his scrapbook. And, of course, the final example is Thomas Jefferson, who after his wife Mary died, never remarried and was, you know, obviously, you know, a great statesman and an incredible Renaissance man and kept a scrapbook full of love sonnets and wrote these long letters to his daughters and told them how important it was that they marry for love and kept their letters in a scrapbook. And so there's this interesting to me that that there's almost a sentimental outlet for men in the keeping of a scrapbook that in a way there isn't with a pure diary, because it's this compendium of things that you bring in, things that you edit, things that you add. There's no holds barred in terms of what those media are, whether it's poetry or clippings from the paper or paintings or postcards or, you know, whatever you want it to be.
Right.
And that's where, you know, I'm slightly not so much critical of contemporary scrapbooking as wanting contemporary scrapbookers to be more forgiving of themselves in terms of the looseness with which all of those old scrapbooks seem to have just this incredible beauty, because they were not restricting themselves to getting it right, to using embellishments the way, you know, you're told to in a class or in a magazine or at the mall. It should just be you. It should be a snapshot of your life. And that can be a receipt. That can be... That could be something from something that someone gives you. It doesn't have to be something that's really, you know, store bought and kind of created to look right and get it right. It's really, that's really not, I think, what it should be about.
And it does seem that if you were a psychologist doing sort of historical comparative psychology, you could look at scrapbooks and kind of make little hypotheses about the psyche. I mean, as you say, now people are, a little more inhibited? I mean, people are still keeping them, I guess.
Well, it's a huge hobby. And when I was researching the contemporary part of the hobby, which I don't really profess to be an expert on by any means, I love some of the materials. I buy some of them myself for my studio. And some of the stuff is really great. Obviously, I would not want to denigrate it or make any kind of sweeping generalization about it. But I will say that in my research, I found that there were interesting dissertations written by social psychologists and psychology students who were looking at scrapbooking as therapy, scrapbooking as an aid in memory retention in Alzheimer's patients. Really interesting things that scrapbooking can be this vehicle, this tool for recovery, for recovering memory, for, in 100 years ago, often people would make scrapbooks for the infirm, so it would give them something to do when they were in bed. And in many ways, it's the same kind of very humane way of seeing this art form. But at the same time, there's at least one woman who wrote a dissertation that I came across that was on the sort of crisis of creativity in scrapbooking, that women were so afraid of getting it wrong that they were very sort of stressed out about the money it cost, the time it took, the effort they made, that their children and in-laws who would be the recipients of their scrapbooks would be disappointed in them for not getting it right, that they would be down on themselves for not having an artistic education that provided them with the means to produce a spectacular scrapbook. And that's when I thought, wait a minute, I've got that education. It doesn't have to look like I did it, because you're not living my life. I'm not living your life. Your life is, you know, whoever you are. And there's no one life that's more valid than another. But what is, I think, true is it's an extremely vernacular art form. So, you know, what I found that people did 100 years ago is they just grabbed what was on their kitchen table and made sense of it, because that was, at the end of the day, that was the day. The day was I worked in the fields, or the day was I went to work in the factory, or the day was I'm a mother or a teacher or a grandmother or a banker or a statesman, and this is what I think is important. And that shouldn't have to cost money. So in a sense, I'm sort of advocating a kind of green scrapbooking, which I think a much more sort of meaningful. There's more fidelity to the self in what I'm proposing. It's not so much being critical of what's out there as much as sort of looking for a renaissance in what people can make that might be informed in some small way by what I uncover in my book.
Jessica Helfand is the author of the book Scrapbooks at American History, published by Yale University Press, and National Scrapbooking Day is this coming May 3rd. What does that mean? Do people get together and have special scrapbook occasions?
I'm assuming, but I don't think they wait for scrapbooking, National Scrapbooking Day. It's a huge booming industry. They've got their own trade show. They've got retreats. And the people that do it love it. There's a reason it's the fastest growing American hobby. It has had a huge surge and also almost mushroom-like surge since 9/11, which, and I'm not the first person to comment on this, that it may have something to do with the fact that in times of sort of difficulty, particularly war, after the Civil War, for example, the whole notion of carpe diem is a very antebellum concept. It's, you know, I wasn't here yesterday, I might not be here tomorrow, but gosh darn it, I'm going to paste this thing in a book. Very much the notion behind scrapbooking. And I think that had a great deal to do with the resurgence of it. It was already around since the kind of ebbing and flowing through the Mormon community, who are, of course, the great genealogists of our country, and all across the Midwest and the Southwest and the South and East, and suddenly it kind of came to a fore, I think, after the great losses of 9/11 in 2001 and became this really huge, fast-growing industry. And it's very creative, and it's very, I mean, I think people, you know, feel very rewarded by recording their own lines. And I think it's become a much more gendered activity, probably due to the fact that women tend to be the archivists of their families. But in tandem with the rise in scrapbooking is the rise in ancestry and family history and genealogy and family trees. You've got Skip Gates doing wonderful things on television and you know, tracing DNA. And so I think that many people are interested. Maybe it's a baby boomer thing. I don't know. Probably in part it is. We're all interested in figuring out where we came from and where we're going. And so to that extent, scrapbooking is a very rewarding exercise in pursuit of all sorts of ways of marking time and marking time for future generations. I just don't think you need fancy supplies to do it.
Right. Jessica Helfand, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe.